ZipRecruiter co-founder and CEO Ian Siegel joins us now. Ian, good to see you again. We've been talking all morning long about inflation, whether it's in commodities or worker wages. From your vantage point, where are you seeing some of the biggest hourly wage increases for workers?
Well, we're seeing wage increase really across the board. The biggest is in leisure and hospitality, where there's just a real struggle to bring people in who are going to work every day in a face-to-face role with the public.
And Ian, what we keep trying to sort of get our arms around what is going to get those people back, right? We've talked before about whether it is wages going up that is going to be the key. What are you seeing throughout the platform? What is most enticing to job seekers?
I mean, that is the fundamental question of the job market today. Previously, we had hypothesized that all of these workers were reluctant to return to work because they were scared of getting sick, or they didn't have childcare, or they were getting stimulus checks, or they didn't have to pay their mortgages. And literally every one of the reasons that we had been talking about is gone now. And yet not only are workers not returning, but they're quitting their jobs at a record rate on top of that, which is putting employers in a real conundrum. And the response from employers has been to effectively roll out the red carpet to these job seekers. They are pulling out every stop they can think of. They're raising wages. They're offering an increased number of jobs with benefits. They're offering flexible schedules. They're literally offering entry-level job seekers the opportunity to go to college and have it paid for. And yet the job seekers still aren't coming. And fundamentally, what we think we're wrestling with here is a question of a change in what people want from work, which is they want remote work. They've tried it during the pandemic. They really like it, and they're holding out until they can try to find it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, 4.4 million Americans quit their jobs in September. What are some of the top reasons they are quitting? Is it the mask mandate? Is it lifestyle changes? Is it a combination of all those things?
I mean, survey after survey after survey, whether it's on ZipRecruiter or on third-party sources, is all telling us the same thing. 55% of job seekers are looking for a job that allows them to work remotely. Again, during the pandemic, people discovered a new, more satisfying way to live. It's the number one perk that employers are offering on ZipRecruiter. 2 years ago, less than 2% of jobs mentioned remote work. Now more than 10% of jobs mention remote work. Those companies that are offering remote opportunities are experiencing the most success in recruiting. However, only about 40% of the jobs in America can be done remotely, which presents a really interesting question about what's going to have to happen to wages or benefits or perks for those jobs that require face-to-face interaction on a daily basis with the public.
Ian, I don't know if you know the answer to this, but this is something I've been trying to wrap my head around. The government numbers, the Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers in the monthly jobs report now show, the last report showed, only 11.6% of workers were teleworking at some point in the prior month because of the coronavirus pandemic. That number seems so low, given what you and many other people are saying about remote work. Like, what is it, a data problem? Is it that people are working in an office even though they don't want to be? What's going on here?
Well, a lot of people have been compelled to go back to the office, particularly over the last quarter. And I think that's a big part of the reason we're seeing this surge in resignations, because before it was a reluctance of job seekers who were unemployed to re-enter the job market. But now we're seeing millions of currently employed professionals quitting their job, good jobs, without having another job lined up, which really, and I feel like I've been using this word a lot over the last 2 years, is unprecedented in the job market. Part of where this is coming from, though, is that job seekers and the currently employed have a record nest egg saved up over the last 2 years. There was a tremendous reduction in their amount of consumer spending that was going on. So they find themselves flush and they have long runways from which to make choices about how they deliberately want to live the rest of their lives. It's going to be really interesting to see how this plays out over the next 12 months, because at some point, these people are going to need to pay rent, they're going to need to pay their mortgages, and they're going to have to return to the job market.
Yes, they are. That brings me to my next question. What does normalization look like? Not just for the job market, but for you guys, right? You've been on a hot streak, a lot of companies looking for jobs. As we see this all sort of smoothing out, how does that look for ZipRecruiter?
Well, the story of ZipRecruiter has been a tale of two sides of a job market. I mean, if you look at the employer side of our job market, we've had three record quarters in a row where the number of employers on our platform looking to recruit just keeps moving to new heights, yet the job seekers have not been returning. And that has created an imbalance, which we are fortunate from a market timing position, but we are also fortunate from a product innovation position, because in a market where there is intense competition for job seekers, having a service like ours, where employers are literally shown a list of algorithmically selected candidates and they can directly recruit them even before they've applied, is an advantage. In the future, I think we're going to see that we're all on a glide path back to a more normal economy and a more normal job market. It's going to take us probably another 12 months to get there. And once that balance happens, it's still going to be an opportune time for recruiting and for job seeking. But right now, I mean, truly, it is a golden age to be a job seeker. You have never seen employers fighting so hard for your attention.
Good way to put it. ZipRecruiter co-founder and CEO Ian Siegel, always good to see you. Have a great rest of the week. All right, according to a new survey from Morgan Stanley, Asset owners consider diversity and inclusion to be the top environmental, social, and governance factor regarding their organization's investment decisions. There's also a near consensus that more diverse investment teams help drive strong financial returns. Let's talk more about this with Morgan Stanley Vice Chairman of Wealth Management and Managing Director, Carla Harris. Carla, always nice to see you. Thanks for taking some time. I was reading this report, and something you wrote about, or your team wrote about at the top, caught my attention. You write about this $1 trillion blind spot that women in multicultural businesses face here. Talk to us about that.
Yes. Well, first of all, thanks for having me, Brian. And that was actually the result of our first white paper that we put out a couple of years ago, where we talked about the fact that women and multicultural entrepreneurs, if they were invested in at the same rate as their opportunity to generate revenue as a percentage of who they are in our economy, it would represent a $1 trillion opportunity, which is a huge opportunity for investors, both institutional and family wealth advisors, as well as high net worth individuals to invest in. And that was really highlighting the inequity of the distribution of capital, both to women and multicultural entrepreneurs. But it's a huge opportunity. So it's not, Brian, about the right thing to do. It's about the commercial opportunity that exists.
Who is doing it best, Carla? I read a little bit further down, and you highlight public pensions seem to be focusing or to be the gold standard in focusing on diversity, right?
Yes, and I'll have to tell you, and that is among large asset owners. So we did the survey of public pension plans, endowments, and foundations. And while 87% of that universe says that they believe that diverse teams give better outcomes, there was still a large percentage of all of those asset owners who still thought that there was a trade-off, with the exception of public pension plans, who, frankly, Brian, have been at it a lot longer than some of these other larger asset owners. And they have deployed strategies like emerging manager programs, but they say very clearly in the survey that there is not a trade-off between investing and having diversity as a priority and the returns that you will get. And part of it, I think, is the experience that they've had over 25 years making this a priority, not just in their investing teams, but more importantly, being intentional and accountable to investing with emerging managers that have been founded by people of color and women.
Carla, it's Julie here. I'm always curious when I see surveys like this, if there is a gap between my intentions and my actions, right? And so when I look at the top ESG factors as found in this survey, diversity and inclusion, human rights, and human capital, I have to wonder, are they really investing this way, or did they just, is it sort of aspirational?
Yes, I got to tell you, Julie, that was the big surprise and aha for me, that there were still so many, 56% of these asset owners who said that they thought that there was a trade-off. And I'll take you back, Julie, to about 15 years ago when the conversation around ESG began, really. People were questioning whether or not you could really do well by also doing good. Now there's a lot of data that's out there that shows that there is no trade-off if you align your priorities around ESG. And let's be honest about it, Julie, the S is quickly becoming the D. It is diversity. And you see public shareholders now asking corporations to be accountable about what they're doing with respect to diversity. And I think that's only going to intensify as we move forward, because millennials and Zers clearly care about this space. And they are becoming the dominant population in the workforce. And they're going to drive a lot of the wealth and a lot of the investments going forward. So the accountability issue that public pension plans have felt, from government mandates to it being part of their legislative mandate, to looking at the underlying constituents in these public pension plans, that accountability is now going to start to spread, I would predict, over to the corporations and their endowments and pension funds, because their shareholders are now going to start to ask the question, who's managing the money? So I am very bullish that we will start to see a transfer of assets to some of these emerging managers, women and multicultural emerging managers.
Yeah, and you also see it on the corporate side, right? Organizations like NASDAQ saying you have to have diverse boards in order to even be listed. So Your optimism is great and amazing here, but it feels like we still have a ways to go, right? So what are you going to want to see in the next 5 to 10 years to further convince you that this is real, right? What kind of milestones or markers are you looking for?
Sure. So here are the recommendations that we make in the report. Number one, to continue to publish the data around the performance of managers that have been founded by people of color and women. Because the more data you put in the marketplace, Julie, the more you're going to see change. Because as I like to say, those who don't get it on the diversity front, they will hug the data. And the data is irrefutable. That's number one. Number two, have a measure of accountability. You know, make sure you standardize your process. I want to see large asset owners have a standard process around asking about diversity at those asset managers where they're looking to deploy funds. You know, who do you have on your investment teams? You know, how have you changed that? How many assets that have you invested in that are founded by women and people of color? So looking at that data, what I'm expecting to see over 5 years is I'm expecting to see a market increase. That's how we'll know whether or not we are in fact making progress. And then to do this survey again. And if we do this survey 12 months from now, 18 months from now, I would expect that we would see far less than 56% of those that are in the survey say that they believe that they're making some type of trade-off there. The other thing that I would expect to see is that consulting firms will also standardize their practice around searching for and doing research around some of those same managers. And you don't see that across the board today.
And finally, Carla, I got to ask, since we were just having this discussion about that there might be a change at the top of the Federal Reserve, as somebody who is at a large bank, is it time for a woman at the top of the Fed?
Now, you know, I'm always going to say the more women we have in positions of leadership, Julie, the better off things will be. So I'm going to leave it right there.
I like it.
Fair enough. Morgan Stanley, Vice Chairman of Wealth Management and Managing Director, Carla Harris. Always nice to see you. Hopefully next time it's back in studio. It's been a while. Have a great rest of the week. Today, Slack is unveiling its vision for the digital headquarters of the future at its annual customer conference called Frontiers. Let's dig into what this vision is with Slack's co-founder and CEO, Stuart Butterfield. Stuart, always nice to see you. I have no earnings questions for you anymore. Of course, your business is now part of Salesforce, so we'll put that off to the side. What is your vision of the digital headquarters of the future?
Well, awesome question, obviously. So it's digital infrastructure that supports productivity and collaboration, and that is a little bit of a mouthful, but think about it like this. Imagine in a parallel universe, we, in March 2020, were all allowed to keep going to the office, but didn't have access to any software, or even make it narrower, didn't have access to any collaboration software. Every one of these businesses, including us, that, you know, that did pretty well over the last couple of years, would have just disintegrated in 48 hours. But the amount of thought and effort and conversation that goes into the physical infrastructure, the, you know, real estate leases and office buildouts and seating plans and conference room design, all of that, it's like a 10 or even a 50 to 1 ratio of thought and effort by leaders. But the digital HQ is what's powering these businesses, is what's holding people together, it's what's enabling productivity. And the good news is it's a lot more malleable. You know, like you don't have all this CapEx and build something out and then have to live with it for a long time, you can evolve really rapidly. And that creates a possibility for a lot of agility and responsiveness on behalf of these businesses that ultimately lets them serve their customers better and be more successful.
I get the sense, Stuart, over the next 12 to 18 months, now that you're part of Salesforce, the interface on Slack might look a little different. What are you guys working on there?
Well, there's a couple of things. So one track at Frontiers of this year, we're announcing like a completely re-engineered version of the platform. And the Slack platform has been hugely successful. There's a million plus active developers. There's just about a million custom integrations created by customers that are in active use. So it's an incredibly powerful platform that has a huge amount of activity. And yet we put all of this friction in front of it. So we're making it a lot easier to give people building blocks and to recombine things. And in a world where more and more people are using more and more software all the time, that interoperability and that kind of lightweight fabric for systems integration is really powerful. On the other hand, we launched Huddles in July, and it's like an audio-only calling alternative because it's not a call. It doesn't start and stop, and people can join and leave at different times. It's already being used by millions and millions of people. It's over a third of our users are active on it weekly. And Clips, video sharing for asynchronous meeting alternatives. And all that stuff is brand new in response to what we learned from ourselves and from customers during the pandemic.
How's the integration going?
It's good. I mean, you know, it's front loaded. We closed in July after a really long wait. So we've had kind of one full quarter, and there's a lot of overhead up front. That's financial systems and HR and stuff like that. That's a kind of a one-time cost, but it's exciting to start to see the teams on the go-to-market side really figure each other out, work on the enablement, start to partner on larger deals. Obviously, we have a lot of mutual customers, and you know, companies like Target and Lowe's, Condé Nast, everything, UNICEF, IBM, IKEA, and all of them, I think, I don't want to speak for them, but I think they're thrilled by this combination because they have investments in both platforms and they really see the power of combining them. So yeah, I think it's, next year will be the year that we really kind of start firing on all cylinders, but it's pretty exciting time right now.
So the synergies that you guys talked about when consummating the deal, all that's on track.
Yeah, I would say so. And to be clear, you know, I also say synergies all the time. There's this connotation of like private equity, like we're doing this to save costs of having one finance team or something like that. That's definitely not it. I think the synergy is really about the degree of adaptability and agility that customers want out of these investments in software systems, because we're really moving from a period, you know, if you think about the first half of the 20th century, it's standardization, and then the second half is automation. And now it's really about taking all of these incredible platforms and tools and services and everything else and making something that's really dynamic and responsive. And if you think back to your experiences as a consumer talking to the customer service department and maybe a bank or an airline or a telco, and they say, I'm sorry, Brian, the system won't let me do that. They're telling the truth, because that top-down approach to big software had a 3-year to 5-year cycle. It had tens of millions of dollars of cost and moved really slowly. So being able to take those pieces apart and reassemble them in a way that suits the business and then do that on an ongoing basis to be really dynamic, it's powerful and exciting, and customers love it.
Stuart, I know you as a big thinker. Does Slack have a role in the metaverse? I'm putting that all these questions to founders of tech companies that I've covered for some time. What's your take on it?
Well, I honestly have no idea. I mean, so the people working on it definitely think so and are eager to partner with us. It might just be a failure of imagination on my part, but like having my Slack messages and notifications show up in an alternate or virtual reality does not have a huge amount of appeal. But I could be just not thinking about it correctly.
Fair enough. Well, one thing you have thought about is your return to work plan. Where do you stand on that? Are you back in a physical headquarters?
I'm not, and I don't intend to be on any kind of regular basis. And I, you know, again, still a little bit of we'll see what happens, but I don't think workers to whom the balance of power has really shifted over the last couple of years across the board, not just in tech, not just knowledge workers, but obviously in retail and service and everywhere. I don't think they're going to want to give up this newfound autonomy and flexibility. I think people still think about 2 days a week in the office is like a reduction, but it's not. It's an increase. We'll be going from 0 days to 2 days, and that's asking people to sacrifice a lot. And that doesn't mean I don't believe that offices have a future or people don't want to get together. They definitely do, and I absolutely do, and I've actually been to a couple offsites in the last few months with extensive testing protocols, and it's really valuable to get people together. But we don't need to be together every day, 9 to 5, Monday to Friday.
Yeah, especially when the metaverse is happening, Stuart, we can just put on our goggles and just connect with each other, or, of course, just connect on Slack. We'll leave it there. Slack's co-founder and CEO, Stuart Butterfield. Good luck at the conference today.
Well, a new documentary out takes a closer look at Tom Brady in the arena. The film Man in the Arena debuts on ESPN Plus tonight, and it's just the latest documentary from Religion of Sports. Take a look.
You just keep putting one foot in front of the other, and you keep trying to make progress. So when I look at over 20 years, I look how far I've come. But there's not one step that I took where I realized, look how far I've come. But those series of steps that I put together, I go, wow, that's quite a journey.
For much more on the film, let's bring in Gautam Chopra. He is the creator and director of Man in the Arena. Tom Brady, he's also the co-founder of Religion of Sports. And Gautam, it's great to talk to you. We should mention, by the way, Tom Brady is also the co-founder of Religion of Sports. You didn't have to travel too far to find your next documentary subject. But talk to me about what drew you to this project and why you felt the need to sort of revisit this story, because you've done other films on him before.
Yeah, so I've been friends with Tom and or collaborators with Tom and sort of become friends with Tom, I'd say, over the last 6 or 7 years. We worked on a prior series called Tom Versus Time, but in 2017. But that was very focused on one season. Tom was turning 40 years old. That was a thing. And we followed him across that season that culminated in yet another Super Bowl, a loss. But, this one, so across all this time that I've gotten to know Tom, we talk about these things. We talk about, like normal, people do, about like, what has he learned across the journey? And as he continues to do it, what is he taking from, each of these seasons and trying to apply in real time as he takes on this new challenge? And so just as a storyteller, I was like, this is really interesting. Let's turn on the camera and start documenting this and telling these stories. Because if you think about it, yes, it's a great sports story. It's also an interesting cultural story, because Tom Brady's been a part of our lives for over two decades. Whether or not you're even a fan, whether or not you like football, you know about Tom Brady. So that sort of became just like the narrative thread that really fueled this project.
Yeah, I have to admit, and great to talk with you, by the way, that I'm not a big football fan. I do know Tom Brady has won 7 Super Bowl rings, and I know you've got a few Emmys under your belt as well. How is this stacking up in the awards arena?
Oh, man. Well, we have a ways to go, at Religion Sports. We've had some early success like Tom, but, what you learn is like in order, I say this seriously, in order to have success across a long period, you have to build a culture, anybody can have a one-off, anybody can bring together the perfect storm, can create something special. But in order to have that consistent success across, in Tom's case, 2 decades, that takes way more than just getting lucky. That's building a culture. And so, as you guys talked to all day long, we're trying to do that with Religion of Sports, and not just in the documentary space, but audio and scripted. And, it's a really fascinating time right now in the media of content space.
It feels like there is a land grab right now in the content space. I mean, there are so many different platforms to get your content out on. How has that changed the thinking for you as a filmmaker? And how do you think that's changed the way storytelling has evolved, particularly in the field of sports?
Yeah. So look, as an entrepreneur, as a co-founder of this company, you know, it's definitely influenced us in terms of strategically and partnerships and how we work with different subjects, teams, organizations, other, you know, media companies, et cetera, streamers. I mean, like you said, there's just this proliferation of opportunities. I would say when it comes to storytelling, it doesn't really change. Sure, youth now, there's different ways to cut up your content, short form, long form, series, et cetera. But at the end of the day, storytelling, you know, there's a sort of purity to it, which I love as a creator. It still comes back to, you know, Joseph Campbell, Hero of a Thousand Faces, the hero's journey. And we sort of pride ourselves both in terms of the story, the content we create, but also how we partner with people, that we're a storytelling company. We're a creator-driven mm-hmm. company, and we place a huge premium on that. So storytelling for us isn't just sort of reality shows and turning on camera and being sort of opportunistic and exploitive. It's about like really focusing on, and we do this with Tom recently, with Russell Westbrook, just all the athletes we work with. It's like, what's the goal? What are we trying to say beyond just sort of tracking you? And so, you know, that's where we've tried to also differentiate ourselves, is really just we're a storytelling company.
What about your ability to monetize the content, though? I mean, we're talking about a visual medium right now with this documentary, but you've got a podcast as well. I mean, it feels like these different pieces are almost inevitable right now when you talk about a rollout of a big film.
Yeah, I mean, you have to. So this goes back to the sort of the other side of the coin, which is the more entrepreneurial, building a business and being very smart about, okay, you know, building, owning IP, exploiting it in different ways. When you capture this content, I mean, we're now living in a world, right, where people are consuming that content in so many different ways. So you definitely have to be conscious on the creative side of that. And, you know, we try to be, Man in the Arena is a perfect example. It's like, it's less about just taking the video content and taking the, you know, what you're cutting room floor or just the transcripts and republishing them on an audio platform. It's okay, where's there more storytelling? How can we build a universe of content around this stuff? So, you know, in this case, there's the premium video series. There's going to be the audio series launches today. There's social content. And it's because what we have found, and I think others have found, is when you have something that consumers or viewers like, they want more, more, more of it. And so, you know, it's on us then to supply that in as many different ways as we can. And to your point, monetize that and really create more opportunity.
Well, certainly looking forward to the film Man in the Arena debuts on ESPN Plus tonight. Gautam Chopra, the co-founder of Religion of Sports and the creator and director behind the film. Great to talk to you.
Well, we've been hearing from the major retailers over the past couple of days, Walmart and Target, saying their inventory seems to be just fine going into the holiday season. But many other companies are not saying that. They're having trouble getting stuff. So let's talk about that whole process that we've been watching so closely. Jason Seidel is Cowen Managing Director of Industrials, Air Freight, and Surface Transportation. So he watches this very closely as well. Jason, thanks for being here. Your latest note was really interesting as it dug into all of this, and you had a panel of different experts that you spoke to. There's one point that really stood out to me that I thought was interesting. A lot of these big retail companies have chartered their own smaller container ships to try to get around this somehow. And as you say in your note, that doesn't help. It actually might be making things worse. Can you explain that to us a little bit?
Sure. So if you look at sort of the port of LA, typically the average TEU size, as the ship size, is about 11,700. The average size of the ships coming in the port now is about 1,700 on the smaller ship side. So you're creating a lot of ships that are sitting out there on the water, and it's kind of clogging up because you still have to get the ship into the port, and then you still have to unload it regardless of the size. Clearly, a smaller ship is going to be quicker to unload, but you still have to get it in the berth. So right now, we're looking at over a month time between anchor and berth time for a ship, which, you know, if you go back earlier in the year, that was in the single digits.
Jason, earlier in the week, we had on Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg. He asked him about the supply chain issues. Take a listen to what he said.
We've seen private sector operators of these supply chains stepping up in remarkable ways to get goods to the shelves, to make sure that they're being creative, using our existing resources 24/7. It's making an impact, and we're going to continue driving that short and medium term change, while for the long term, we make sure we have better ports, better rails, better roads, so that our core infrastructure that all of those private sector processes play out on is more resilient for whatever challenge of the future could come.
Jason, what should the private sector be doing here to help alleviate this problem?
I think people are doing what they can right now. So clearly some of the larger retailers that have in-house logistics operations and very experienced ones are doing their part. But it goes beyond just a handful of large retailers, right? So it goes to the port truckers, it goes to the warehousing operations, it goes to the railroads. This is an entire supply chain. And so these are all links in the chain. If you look at, right now, yeah, things are bad now, but the calendar is going to be our friend with seasonality. Typically, post Thanksgiving, the ports get a lot slower. I think we're going to get about a month to clean up. Normally, in a normal year, we probably get a little bit of January to clean up too. But this year is a little different because Lunar New Year is coming early. So I think January is going to be, slogging back with more ships again.
So when do you think things will get back to, quote unquote, normal, whatever normal is?
Sure. So sort of our baseline view right now is things get a little bit better in December. Then we get tight again in January. We start probably clearing up around 2Q and into the back half of the year. Look, we have an infrastructure bill that is signed into law. That's fantastic. We've needed one for over a decade. It appropriates about $17 billion to the ports, to all different projects. That's going to help, but that's not going to really get us any near-term help. That's more the long-term help that Secretary Buttigieg was talking about in your clip.
Jason, what stocks do you like off of this?
Sure. So I think we're going to concentrate on three stocks. So let's talk about Hub Group first. That's ticker symbol HUBG. It is an intermodal marketing company, so kind of like a middleman. They have a lot of their rail pricing already locked in from the major rail carriers, and they're pretty confident they're going to be pricing well above their rail cost inflation right now. So that's going to really help in the beginning of the year as we're still sort of tied up. And in the back half of the year, as we anticipate the fluidity increasing across the rail network, that should help not only with their turn times for their assets, but also should bring some of their costs down. So we like Hub Group as number one. Number two, we like Canadian Pacific on the railroad side. CP is in the process of trying to buy Kansas City Southern. And if you look at the three things that have sort of held back Kansas City Southern's top line, it's intermodal, it's automotive, and it's refined products. Now, refined products is a temporary shift to trucking. The laws of economies of scale dictate that that's probably not a long-term event. It'll find its way back to the railroads. On the automotive side, it's a chip issue. It's the broader supply chain. And our chip analysts are telling us that by 23, we should be okay. And on the intermodal side, it's a little bit different at KSU. They're a major port in Mexico. They serve Lázaro Cárdenas. That's being impacted by a teacher strike. So they're actually sitting on the rail lines into the port. So it's pretty tough to get in and out when you can't run your trains. We think by the time CP takes over, these three things that have been holding back the top line will be alleviated for them. And the last one I want to highlight is more of a trucking call, and it's a little bit of an infrastructure play as well. So clearly we've had some problems hiring truckers lately. I've been around the trucking industry almost 30 years, and I've never quite seen it this bad. However, you have one Daseke, DSKE. They are 100% flatbed, the most exposure to the flatbed industry. Now, the infrastructure bill that I referenced, it's about $1.2 trillion. And all these projects that are going to flow in are going to do two things. Number one, they're going to steal from the truck driving market, right? So we're going to have these guys going to the construction market, swinging a hammer rather than driving a truck and getting home every night. But at the same time, we're going to require more drivers to haul some of this freight that's being used in the construction project. So we like Daseke for their exposure to that.
This is really interesting stuff, Jason. And I want to have you back perhaps next month as we maybe start to get over that first hump of Thanksgiving that you were talking about. Jason Seidel.
Fingers crossed.
Thanks so much. Yes, appreciate your time this morning.
Welcome back to Yahoo Finance Live. Porsche is doubling down on its EV future, unveiling the Taycan GTS at the LA Auto Show. Let's head back out to the LA Convention Center where Pras Subramanian is standing by with Porsche's product manager. Pras.
Thanks, Akiko. Yeah, we're here at the LA Auto Show. Porsche coming here full force. Like you said, five new cars here, but we're talking about a really special one right in front of us. So Frank Weissman, Porsche Product Communication Manager, is here with me. Let's talk about this car right here, the Taycan GTS. Justin Dale, tell me about this car.
Yeah, thanks, Pras. Thanks for stopping by. So Taycan GTS, a very exciting debut. The Taycan has been on the market for about 2 years now. So we've launched the Taycan sedan range from the rear-wheel drive car, around $80,000 to start, all the way up to the crazy Turbo S, 2.6 seconds to 60, the Cross Turismo, which is a little more of a rugged crossover take on the car with a new body style, more headroom, more trunk space. And now the Sport Turismo is our third body style. The same headroom trunk space as the Cross Turismo, but more of a road tune, which fits perfectly with the GTS. GTS, as you know, is the performance focused tier between the S or 4S and Turbo models. So a great blend of standard performance options while still retaining a high degree of everyday usability, comfort, and a car that you just enjoy driving. With the Taycan, we all have a lot of capability to tune different chassis systems and the powertrain to make the car feel more dynamic. And the GTS is the most sportily calibrated, if you will, car in the Taycan range in terms of its chassis tuning and just the way it's focused on drivers that really enjoy going around a corner but also still want that utility every day.
Now let's talk about the Taycan. You know, that whole product range really put that whole product range really put Porsche on the map from an EV point of view, a relevance point of view. And even here in California, the Taycan is very popular. So talk to me about this car here, but also just in general, that the range, the EV range for Porsche.
Yeah, so California, we're here in Los Angeles, which we're very excited about to be back here once again. A hugely important market for us. If California were a market on its own country, it would be the fourth largest market in the world for us. And in terms of Taycan, 30% of the Taycans we sell in the U.S. are sold in the state. So a huge following, huge appreciation for the car here. Yes, the car, now that the model line is essentially fully fleshed out for the time being, we were really excited about it. We're excited about the response. The challenge we had was making an EV that was built from the ground up. As you know, it's a unique platform. It's not based on anything else. But also making it a compelling car to drive, making it appealing to new customers, but also to true Porsche enthusiasts. And the response we've been getting is that we've done that well, which we like to hear. But we continue working on the car every day to make it better and better. And the Taycan GTS is the latest iteration of that, 3.5 seconds to 60, but with everyday utility. You could charge it at home. You could charge it in the ever-expanding network of high-speed chargers. So the best of both worlds. And we're really excited to be in this space with the Taycan and that it's doing so well.
So let's chat about more about the enthusiasts here with regards to EV. And I'm talking about the Mission R right behind me, the electric sports car. Now, I know this is a concept, but, you know, are we going to see a world where this is going to be raced really in tracks across the world?
So those are the exact thoughts we're having. Porsche sells race cars. We sell them through Porsche Motorsport, in this case in the U.S. through Porsche Motorsport North America. So that's where our racing customers that race in series like Michelin Pilot Challenge with something like a GT4 Club Sport or the Carrera Cup North America series with a 911 GT3 Cup car. They are customers of Porsche through Porsche Motorsports. The Mission R is an outlook on what customer racing in a one-make series, where everyone has the same car and the same chance of winning depending on how good of a driver they are and how they set the car up. The Mission R is an outlook on what that could look like in a number of years. So as you said, it's a concept right now, but we're thinking about a potential future with an all-electric one-make racing series to continue to be able to offer customers that want to go racing an opportunity to do so with Porsche, even when it's no longer necessarily with a combustion engine powered race car. So this car has technology that won't be out today, won't be out tomorrow, but you may find some of it in a race or road car in the future. Motorsport has always been our test bed, so the Mission R is another step into the future in that direction in terms of sustainable, fully electric motorsport potential at Porsche, because we're always thinking about racing. That's what part of the reason what brought us to where we are today.
So does this Mission R maybe hint at a possible Porsche EV sports car?
Not at the moment. Those are obviously thoughts we're having. We're looking at that potential. As you know, the 911, for example, has the potential to be made a hybrid in terms of its architecture. But that's not a decision that has been made yet. When we look at sports cars in particular, we're concerned about weight. We're looking at performance. We want that driving potential in terms of the car's capabilities, but also the enjoyment to be there. So I wouldn't rule it out, but we've not made any decision or announcement on an all-electric two-door. The Taycan is our electric sports car right now, and if you've seen the car perform on track, you've, I think, had the chance to drive it. I'm sure you can attest that we're already pretty well established in that space for now, but stay tuned. As you know, we have plans to electrify more cars, more model lines of ours in the future. The Macan will be the next one. We will be showing a Macan EV to the public as a road car in a few years' time. And the plan will evolve from there, but stay tuned.
Right, so we're talking about, you know, the Taycan is here, Macan is the next one. You mentioned Macan is the highest volume seller, I believe, for Porsche. The EV model was announced. What do you know, what do we hear, what do we have in terms of details about that car and release date and things like that?
Yeah, so we said that the Macan would be fully electric, the next generation. We recently refreshed the existing car, which will be available for the next couple of years. What we're doing is we're looking at each market and each customer individually in terms of what are the regulations to sell cars, which are ever-changing, and something we obviously focus on a lot. And then what are the customers saying? The EV infrastructure, charging infrastructure is different from market to market. Legal regulations to make cars road legal are different from market to market. So we're looking at a three-pronged powertrain strategy between purely combustion engine cars, plug-in hybrids, and fully electric cars to be able to offer customers in every market that we sell cars in the breadth of ability and offering that we can so they can make their choice. And the Macan EV will be the next step in that. Again, we haven't announced an exact date. We'll still take some time, but we have announced that it is coming. And we're looking forward to sharing more details in due course.
All right, well, the whole product, Porsche product range is here in full force, all the different powertrains. Frank Weissman of Porsche, thank you so much. I really appreciate it, man.
Thank you.
Representative Nancy Mace, a Republican from South Carolina, introducing legislation this week to decriminalize marijuana. Some of her conservative colleagues, though, that are critical of the bill, they're vowing to stop her efforts. Well, we want to discuss this with Representative Mace. She's joining us now from D.C. And Congresswoman, it's great to see you. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
And thank you for having me today.
So we want to talk a little bit more about this bill. This proposal is getting some pushback from some of your conservative colleagues. There's a similar bill that's being discussed in the Senate, led by Democrats Chuck Schumer, just to name one of the members here, that is leading those efforts. Talk to us just about how the bills differ and why not make this a more of a bipartisan effort.
Well, this bill is meant to be bipartisan. I've worked on cannabis legislation before I ever came to Congress as a state lawmaker in South Carolina. I drafted this bill, put a lot of thought and effort into making it palatable to members of both parties on both sides of the aisle. This particular bill, it does decriminalize it, deschedules it off of Schedule 1, but there are different unique ways that is different. There are prohibitions against advertising and marketing to kids under the age of 21. The way that it's regulated, more like alcohol than anything else, using the USDA for growers, ATF for product, TTB for interstate commerce. There are imports and exports provided for, I'm going to call it FDA light for medical cannabis that's been legalized in states for medical use. And then this really gives states, doesn't change anything for states today. So for example, there are 47 states that have some form of cannabis reforms or legalization in their state. My home state of South Carolina, they allow for and permit CBD. Florida has medical cannabis. Places like California and Colorado, they have adult use cannabis. And so this bill recognizes every state is different and doesn't change that, but allows the federal government to get out of the way, have a low excise tax and regulatory framework for states to operate the way they already are today and have been for years and in some cases decades.
And it would allow essentially the banking aspects of the businesses which are legal in states that have allowed it to take place to be legal so that they could bank as opposed to having to do all of these things in cash. But I'm curious.
Correct.
President Biden has, I believe, at one point it was opposed to this. So if you get this through the House and it is a bipartisan effort in the Senate and it passes, what guarantee do you have maybe that Biden would support it or would he veto it?
Well, we don't know at this point. I'm trying to add on more Republicans to the bill. And then we're talking to Democrats, both in the House and the Senate. We're getting a lot of great feedback from both sides of the aisle. People know that it's past time that we do this. This is not a controversial issue. The only place this is controversial is in Washington, D.C. The vast majority of Americans, about 70%, agree that we need cannabis reforms, that this needs to happen in this country, including my home state of South Carolina, where it's a 70-30 issue. So it's past time that federal law catches up to where states have already been. It's very much common sense. It's low taxes. It gets the federal government out of the way of what's already happening. And, the push of the American people and industry, we're talking about a $25 billion industry this year. And by 2025, we're talking about a $75 billion industry. Imagine that kind of economic impact, not only through the taxes and funding that we could do to provide safer communities and educate kids and prevent and reduce the opioid epidemic in many states. This is a really good bill that both sides of the aisle really, I believe, will support in the end. And it's a starting point too. So,
yeah, and Representative, what are some of the conversations that you're having with some of your colleagues on the GOP side who have come out and have come out against this bill, vowing to strike it down if it does go to a vote? How are you, I guess, what are those conversations like? And how are you addressing some of their biggest concerns?
I haven't seen those comments, so I'd want to look at them before I responded on what they're saying specifically about the bill they do not like. This was drafted in a way that I believe has something to offer for everyone, whether you're conservative, whether you're moderate, whether you're on the left or progressive or Republican. There's something for both sides of the aisle here. And that's why I spent a lot of time. I spent about 9 months on this bill, something that I campaigned on. And I put a lot of thought into making it comprehensive, but a very simple framework that both sides of the aisle can support. And let's face it, not everyone will support this kind of legislation. It's never been 100% fealty on this particular issue, but it is one where we have to catch up with what's already happening. And as you were mentioning earlier, with this bill, if it were to be signed into law today, there's no need for a Safe Banking Act because these businesses that are already operating legally in their states would be recognized federally as legal businesses as well. So, I'd want to see the comments, but I do want to say there were some comments from the state party, Republican Party in South Carolina that I am aware of that came out the day this bill was filed. It's ironic because CBD was legalized in South Carolina by a Republican legislature, a very Republican state. There's an effort by Republicans in South Carolina to offer medical cannabis. That will be a hearing on that bill in January. So this is really a nonpartisan issue. And if we're going to do it responsibly, then we've got to do it together. And Republicans have to have a seat at the table. Not only that, we've got to have a voice in the conversation, be part of crafting such an effort.
You know, I'm glad you brought up the state Republican Party, because this seems like a pure, hey, this is a state's rights issue. And what your bill does is let the states determine. But when you bring up the Republican Party, I mean, you're taking a stance here against the old guard. And it's refreshing to see younger people like you rising in leadership in Congress. But what's the message when a state party has said, we're going to oppose you despite the record you played out for us? Or even what we saw, it's not related to cannabis, but the Republican Party in Wyoming, you know, essentially trying to expel Liz Cheney. What is the message Republican state parties are sending to people like you?
Well, certainly for someone like me, I actually campaigned on this issue. And when we talk about kicking people out of parties and censoring our own members and those kinds of things, we really ought to unify. And we saw how Glenn Youngkin unified the party in Virginia and what the end result was, which was pretty remarkable, enormous swing that independents came back to Republicans with the way that he won Virginia. And we saw that in race after race after race in the last few weeks. But when we unify together as a party and we offer solutions and we don't just say, point at each other or point at Democrats and say, well, they're just bad and we're not going to work with them. That's not the way to move this country forward and to bring people together. And in the age of divisiveness, I've been a victim of political violence. I had someone spray paint my house this summer. My car was keyed last year and I'm a single mom. I get threats from the far right and the far left. We've got to have strong leaders with strong minds and strong backs who are willing to push back when these things kind of happen and offer a solution to move our nation forward.
Representative Nancy Mace, it was great to have you. Thanks so much for taking the time, and we hope to have you back on Yahoo Finance soon.